Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the NASCA Stop Child Abuse Now Blog Talk Radio Show. NASCA is the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And so it's NAASCA. We are on Monday through Friday evenings from, well, I'm not going to say the time because people are from all over the world. They call in and listen. So, but we're so glad to have you. This evening we have kind of an open mic forum, and but we do have a special co-host this evening. So I will introduce him in just a minute. But So we're also on scan number 3137. So this is the number that you can look back on and find this show. If you would like to call in and be a part of the panel, we'd love to have you. That number is 646-595-2118. And we have a single purpose here at NASCA, and that is to address issues that are related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. One, by educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, also known as CSA, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, everyone, and two, by offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And again, we are on scan number 3137 this evening. And again, we'd love to have you call in and be a part of the panel. And that number is 646-595-2118. And my beautiful co-host, Penelope, or Victoria, it looks like I've got two of them this evening, will meet you on the back line and bring you in if you have a question. So this evening, we're doing a Q&A call-in discussion with a survivor professional, so using an open mic forum. So we'd love to have you call in and participate. We'll feature a survivor professional co-host who's going to field some questions brought to you by the listener. Tonight, our special co-host is Dean Tong from Port Richey, Florida. He is a trial consultant, author, nationally certified child forensic interviewer, and subject matter expert. I'm also a forensic trial consultant, he says, and an expert in the area of cognitive child development psychology and structured interviews of children allegedly molested, child sex abuse therapy, parental alienation, sexual interest in deviancy, I'm sorry, I didn't know that word, and child abuse investigations in juvenile, criminal, family, and administrative courts across America. He has a website, which is www.abuse.com, And on these episodes, like you said, we welcome various co-hosts and survivor professionals who will help assist us in fielding questions and lead a variety of topics suggested by our call-in participants. Their trauma-informed perspectives as survivor professionals will help them guide discussions on the issue of child abuse, trauma, and healthy human sexuality that springs from questions and topics brought to you by our listeners. So everyone is invited to engage on tonight's show. You can also visit NASCA.org on the web, NASCA.org, and listen to us there. It always looks up the scan number as well. So my name is Kim Lakin. Welcome. I sometimes forget to introduce myself. So welcome, everybody, to the show this evening. I'm going to go ahead and bring Dean on. So, Dean, you are on the air. Thank you for being here,
Kim,
this evening.
Thank you for having me this evening, Kim.
Yeah, we've got a few people that have called in on the panel, so that's exciting.
First of all, I want to acknowledge that child sexual assault is a pervasive problem. Certainly, it's an issue that has to be investigated competently by Child Protective Services and the authorities, the child advocacy centers across America and Canada who interview children allegedly abused, conduct these forensic interviews, the rape assault centers that conduct the anogenital rape examinations. Usually it's a multidisciplinary team approach and methodology, which is great. Everybody working in concert to help the child victim. But I specialize pretty much on the flip side. I'm kind of a horse of a different color. And I see a lot of unfounded, unsubstantiated cases, occasionally false cases, perhaps in a high-conflict divorce or custody battle or parenting time dispute where a parent may be wielding a child as a pawn, weapon, or tool. In a custody battle, raising this allegation based on timing of litigation to get custody, to get child support, to get social status as the most fit parent, and tip the scales. And, of course, I see this dynamic in other situations that don't involve high-conflict divorces or custody battles as well. I get a lot of criminal cases, and I'm hired not just by individuals who have been arrested and charged, who pay big-time fees to attorneys, but those who have no resources are able to obtain my services, even if they're indigent, or in law it's called informa pauperis. They can go through the Office of Public Defense Services. So the accused has a right to a defense that includes not just lawyers but experts. So I'm allowed to give opinions, multiple opinions in the areas of cognitive developmental child psychology, evidence-based best practices of the child forensic interviews, the overall handling of the investigation by Child Protective Services and the authorities, whether the case involves what we call parental alienation and or said sexual allegations in divorce, which is a theory first published in 1987 by psychologist Blush and Ross out of Michigan. And basically, I'm allowed to give these opinions in all courts, dependency courts where parents a parent could have their rights terminated by a juvenile court judge, a criminal court where you're facing felony conviction, prison, lifelong sex offender registration, family court, obviously, where parenting time and custody come to play, and administrative courts where they can CPS can place your name internally on their child abuse registry on a blacklist of suspected abusers. Most of these courts, the burden of proof is the preponderance of evidence, more evidence than not, 51%. So it's a very slippery slope. It's a very gray area. It's an area where a judge will rule in the child's best interest and oftentimes can make a mistake on the side of caution, on the side of the child against the accused. So while I agree that there are many victims out there, there are also victims on the unfounded or false side of this coin, and there's little help for them. There's plenty of help on the actual side of bona fide abuse. And of course, I get this question asked of me all the time. If I consult and testify on the state side, on the prosecution side, and I don't. And I don't really because I'm so busy helping those wounded innocents who find themselves, as I say in my book, Elusive Innocence, in the three-ring circus, juvenile, family, and criminal court, all at the same time, perhaps with a well-meaning, well-intentioned attorney, but who may be misguided, who did not receive proper education in law school on how to handle a case like this. These are specialized cases. They're not taught in law school. And oftentimes I see lawyers needing my help, not just in strategy and theory, but in formatting questions on direct and cross and redirect and recross of all fact and expert witnesses in the case. So it's a highly complex area of law and litigation and science. And the deck is very stacked against the accused. And while I appreciate what NASCA does, certainly you guys do a great job. There are other organizations out there like RAIN, RAINN.org in America, MOSAC, MOSAC, Mothers of Sexually Abused Children, and D2L, Doctors to Light. So there's a lot of help out there on the side of actual abuse, but there's little help on the side for those, you know, on the other side, those who are actually defending allegations where the accused remains vigilant to that he or she did not perpetrate abuse and is up against a mountain of money and players against them in a court of law. And like I said, I do get cases where moms lose custody, where moms are falsely accused of coaching their kids to falsely accuse the dads of incest or other crimes. And certainly those are more the exception than the rule in my caseload because there's so little help for men and fathers who've been wrongly accused of child sexual assault and child abuse and help out there. So it's a controversial area, obviously. It starts with the suggestibility, the level of suggestibility with the child and memory, the memories of the child, and whether the memories are spontaneous and reliable and trustworthy, or whether they've been contaminated, adulterated, and tainted. So lawyers bring me in all the time in cases to critique the child forensic interviews captured on DVD at the child advocacy centers. And I'm going over the interviews to glean whether the interviewers use leading, suggestive, direct, repeated, forced choice, and questions that entail what we call negative stereotype induction, where they may have vilified the accused in the questions. So obviously, it's very important that you don't put words or thoughts or ideas in the child's mind and contaminate the child's information. Only 5% of these cases contain medical traumatic findings, 5%, so 1 out of 20. So 95% of these cases are child victim hearsay. He said, she said, what a child said. This is Rule 803. This is the exception to the hearsay rule. It comes into evidence on the record. It's what places the accused in handcuffs and starts a criminal case. It is what causes Child Protective Services to take your kids from you and place them in foster care or with relatives pending court hearings. And you're guilty until proven innocent and have to prove a negative to prove your innocence. My website, abuseexcuse.com, has been on the Internet now for over 25 years, back to 1997. And trust me, when I get a case, it's a lot of work. You just have no idea how much work it is, not just in my lap to do my job, but to, in part, babysit the attorney and to help the attorney guide the case along through hearings, contested hearings. So, for example, in America, most states are governed by what we call Daubert, D DAUBERT is the case law that governs the admissibility of science and expert testimony here in America in most states. In your country of Canada, it's MOHAN, M-O-H-A-N, is the governing case law, similar to Daubert. Basically, Daubert says that the science or theory the expert is testifying to must be peer-reviewed, must be published, must have a known error rate, must be scientifically reliable, and must be accepted by the general psychological scientific community. So those are the criteria, those are the factors that a judge goes by to glean whether it is junk science or whether it is genuine science that an expert is testifying to. So I testified at a lot of those hearings, basically science and controversy contested hearings. And I have to sometimes do the legal research also, not just the scientific research, but the legal research for the attorneys and the paralegals as well. Because you know, I've been doing this now for decades, and obviously it's like anything else in life, I guess. When you do something long enough, you get pretty good at it. So for me, as a specialist, I get a lot of consults. I have consulted on about 25,000 cases since the mid-90s, and I've been hired in over 1,000 cases of those 25,000. That doesn't include the cases where judges are approving my retention for the accused who doesn't have the resources to fight back. So if you're involved against CPS in a juvenile dependency case, possibly facing a loss of your parental rights, termination of your parental rights, if you're facing jail, prison, for a sexual assault crime that you did not commit, to be mindful, it's not what you know, it's not what you think you know, it's what you can prove that you didn't do what you're accused of doing, right? So advantage state when you're arrested. And of course, all the advantages go to the child, as they should. So you're basically climbing Mount Everest here. But the point is, the accused in either situation, juvenile and or criminal court, has the entitlement to a defense, which includes not just counsel, but experts. These cases will get the best of most attorneys. What I mean by that is, say it's a criminal case, you know, the prosecutor is going to come out and basically, in opening statement, make the statement that children don't lie, children are not mistaken about sexual assault, they must be believed and protected at all costs, a statement that prosecutors and CPS attorneys across America use in these types of cases. Now, statistically, only about 5 to 10% at the most are false. So you probably ask yourself, how do I get so many cases if only 5 to 10% are false? Well, by false, I mean bad faith, premeditation, malice aforethought. Somebody is picking up a telephone, for example, in my state of Florida, where I'm based, calling 1-800-96-ABUSE, which is our child abuse toll-free hotline in our capital of Tallahassee, and ruining somebody's life. That person knew what he or she was doing beforehand, made that call to get that person investigated and kids taken away and perhaps charged criminally. So those are the exception to the rule. Those are only 1 out of 20, maybe 1 out of 10 cases. But the majority of cases are unsubstantiated. And we see about 15 to 20% at most that are substantiated. So there's a lot of cases in that gray area. And, of course, prosecutors and Child Protective Services attorneys will say, well, just because we could not preponderate the allegations and rise to 51% more evidence than not, doesn't mean he didn't do it. That's a good point. What did I just say? It's not what you know. It's not what you think you know. It's what you can prove. So I'm a guy who doesn't like to play the let's wait and see what happens game. I'm always a firm believer of an aggressive defense, against these allegations, because if you didn't do what you're accused of doing in basically this credibility shootout between you and a child and perhaps the parent behind the child, then you better be able to prove it. And that's the $64,000 question that has to be answered successfully, because a lot of lawyers out there, you know, they will be very quick to take your retainer check, but slow to deliver on results, if they ever deliver results that are favorable to the accused. So people must be mindful of the fact that this is a Child Protective Services agency. This is not a family reunification agency. That is absolutely their second goal. Their initial goal and really only goal is to protect the child, which it should be. But there has to be a balance. There has to be a balance for parental rights. And I provide an expert service that helps provide that balance for accused parents that haven't done anything wrong. I have a case now where a father and stepfather, both, is accused of molestation of an older girl, teenager. And he's facing, along with his wife, who's the mother, termination of parental rights of his younger children. And, of course, the mother is charged with failure to protect. So when I tell attorneys, you know, if we're going to win this case, counsel, we have to clear the accused, the primary accused, which is the father/stepfather, and then the mother is accused by proxy, because the mother is believing the father/stepfather didn't do anything wrong, didn't commit any crimes, didn't perpetrate sexual assault.
She knew about it.
She knew about it. She knew. She knew what her daughter told her. But you know, so we have tests out there. One of the tests is called the ABLE Assessment for Sexual Interest. The website is ablescreening.com, A-B-E-L, screening.com. This is our gold standard child sex test, which assesses one's sexual interest or arousal level in children versus consensual relations with an adult woman. Most men are accused of this versus women, obviously. We have had a rash of female teachers accused over the years of molesting high school students and the like. But more times than not, in a high conflict divorce or custody battle, it's the father or stepfather who's the accused, not the mom. So, yes, in this case, the mother absolutely knew about it. The mother absolutely gravitated to her husband's innocence. Well, she got nailed for doing that, and they took her kids away, kids who were not involved in the molestation allegation. And they're little kids. And so, you know, it becomes a very high mountain to climb to be able to balance the equation here, because you're fighting Big Brother, you're fighting Uncle Sam, you're fighting the government in these cases. And obviously, you are the unpopular, controversial side of this coin when you walk into a court of law. That would be me under oath as the expert witness. That would be our attorney. That would be the accused. You know, I represented a mother down here in Daytona Beach, Florida, a few years ago as a defense expert, and she didn't have the resources to hire me, so the judge ordered the state to pay my fees for my work and my time. And this mother was accused of falsely accusing the father of anal sodomy of their 4-year-old son. And, you know, I looked at the child's DVD interview, and I didn't see anything there that was consistent with the mother coaching the kid to wrongly accuse the father. And we had multiple experts, multiple PhDs and MDs involved in this case as well. And they didn't follow proper protocol. So, you know, when I said it's a lot of work earlier in my talk here, you have to look at the CPS policy and training manual. You have to look at the, down here in Florida, it's called the CPT, Child Protection Team Policy and Training Manual. They have different policy and training manuals. And make sure that, you know, the government dotted their I's and crossed their T's. And I'm pretty much the only person who can testify to that when I'm on a case. Certainly the accused can't testify to that. Lawyers cannot testify. They file motions and petitions and argue the case in a court of law, so they're not testifying. So my role is pretty important. If I have a client who has been falsely accused.
Yeah. You know, excuse me, I just had to talk and it didn't come out. This might be a good time. We're almost a half an hour in. That is so much great information. And I couldn't write fast enough, everything that you're saying. So I love it. So do you mind if we take a break for a minute and maybe ask
not
some questions?
Not at all.
Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
Great. So first of all, I was curious, could you tell me a little bit about how you go about the process of figuring out if a child is telling the truth or not? I do darkness to light. I'm an instructor and a facilitator.
Yeah,
so,
we can't do that as experts.
Talk about it.
So we can talk about it, but in these cases, we're not allowed to determine the credibility of any witness, including the child, or the ultimate issue at bar, which is whether the child was sexually abused or not. Only a judge or a jury can say that. That's a Rule 704 issue. That's an ultimate issue of fact that can only be decided by a fact finder, which is a judge or jury. So I can lead the horse to the water, but I can't make him drink it, obviously. That's up to a judge or jury. And oftentimes it's grounds for a mistrial in a criminal case if an expert was to say, I believe the child or I believe the accused. Can't do that. Can't go there. Same thing is, you know, you can't say, you know to a degree of a reasonable degree of medical certainty or psychological certainty that the child has been sexually abused. You can't say that. Only a judge or a jury can say that.
Okay. You can just say, this is what I'm finding.
I can say whether the government approached this from a objective trauma-informed approach, or they adhere to evidence-based best practices, or they did not.
Yeah.
And then we get into a scientific confrontation. That's up for a judge to decide.
Okay.
So when I get involved, as you can imagine, oftentimes my cases are a battle of the experts, where I'm going up against a medical doctor or a psychologist.
Yeah, I bet that's fun. So we have my beautiful co-host Penelope on with us and a couple other people. So I'm going to go ahead and bring Penelope on. Penelope, are you there? You're on.
I am.
It's Dean.
I am. Thank you, Kim. And thank you, Dean, for being on tonight. And by the way, I think we're almost neighbors, Dean, because I'm over here in Sarasota, Florida. A little down from where,
you're a little south of me.
Yeah, hopefully you guys don't have the red tide as badly as we do right now.
I've read about it.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
But
definitely something that is, transient, unlike the long-term effects of childhood abuse and sexual child abuse. And,
Sorry to hear.
Yeah. As I'm listening, you know, here's something that I have a question. I know, I'm very thankful that you're on and with your expertise. in some of these areas that I'm not as familiar with. But my question is pretty generic. And I know in the beginning of your introduction, you were talking about, obviously, you know, when children are some of the false accusations when a parent manipulates, you know, a child in terms of their claims of sexual abuse where no sexual abuse is perpetrated. That is initiated by a parent. My question to you is, in your experience, you may or may not have the answer to this, how often does a child, without being prompted by a parent, but how often does a child claim sexual abuse perpetrated by a parent or guardian that is unsolicited or unsolicited, right? This comes directly from the child, the child's testimony, the child's claim without any adult interference. How often does a child claim a false claim?
I'm not going to use the word false, but I'll use unsubstantiated, and I'll probably say about 60 to 70% of the time. And I understand we're taking out the area of motive and method and means and opportunity because we don't have another parent who could be manipulating or brainwashing or coaching the kid. But what we do have is possibly triggers, sexual triggers. And that can cause the production of what we call schemas. And schemas are enzymes or proteins that can alter or modify one's memory. And that can cause misinformation. So if you look at all the studies by my mentor, Dr. Stephen Ceci, that's spelled C-E-C-I, and his book, Jeopardy in the Courtroom, Jeopardy in the Courtroom was published in 1995. And it became one of the best-selling books ever published by the American Psychological Association, probably, I think, won the most awards ever from the American Psychological Association. But the point was Dr. Ceci did all these studies, Mousetrap, Monster in the Box, Sam Stone, and his most famous study, Genital Conditioning, where he proved that young children can be so suggestible that they can make mistakes, not that they're falsely accusing, but they're committing what we call source misattribution errors. They're making mistakes on the source of the so-called abuse or the source of their trauma. Okay, and even ATSA, and I belong to ATSA, ATSA.com is the Association for the Treatment and Prevention of Sexual Abuse, is the largest professional organization in America on this topic. They published a task force report in 1996, which even basically coaxed all professionals in these cases to be totally objective and to consider multiple hypotheses, alternative hypotheses, not only pertaining to a child's signs, symptoms, behaviors, and disclosures, but also their source and origin of their trauma, that it may be something else besides. Okay, I get cases where, you know, three-year-olds are over-sexualized and touching themselves, and you get a very, you get a very hysterical mom who's a protective mom, make no mistake. She's not trying to get anybody in trouble here maliciously. But, you know, she'll start taping the child or she'll start asking leading or suggestive questions to the child. And all of a sudden, she could be pouring gasoline on a fire and getting answers from the child that are just not true. Okay, kids don't have the same brain formation as we do as adults. And it's the psychological age of reason is 7 to 8, where that's the age where they absolutely should know right from wrong, truth from lie, good touch from bad touch, from secret touch. Not that they can't be before that age, but I just had a case where, the child said the accused put his head in his diaper, and he's double digits age now. So there's no way he could cognitively recall that at that tender age of probably two and a half. Three and a half is about as young as you could be to go back and be able to recall an event like that. So, yeah, this is a scientific minefield, if you will, and certainly a legal minefield, because the lawyers, most lawyers, just have no knowledge of the science here. And, you know, they're taking big-time cases with a lot hanging in the balance, a parent's rights to these kids, criminal charges where, like I said, felony conviction, prison, and sex offender registration are clearly waiting for that person down the road,
mm-hmm.
Whether they plea bargain or they go to trial and lose and get a jury conviction. So, yeah, they're very complex. They're very difficult. And Dr. Cece, his work was probably the most groundbreaking work in this field of child and human development some 30 years ago, is when he started rapidly publishing a lot of articles on this. He is the, or at least he was, I haven't communicated with him in quite a while, he was the Helen Carr Professor of Child Development in Ithaca, New York at Cornell University. So, you know, and then my other colleague, Dr. Phil Esplin, E-S-P-L-I-N, Dr. Esplin was the original co-author of the what's called the NICHD model. The NICHD model is our evidence-based best practices model for interviewing children forensically. And so you have to, when you interview a child, you have to ask open-ended, non-leading questions. Not a question like, did daddy touch your pee-pee? That's direct. It's asking for a yes-no response. It's leading. It's suggestive.
Right.
So you have to you have to tap into the child's unconscious, implicit memory, the same memory that when the child gets up in the morning, the child is going to the bathroom, taking a shower, combing his or her hair, putting their jeans or dress on. They don't have to think about it. Same thing here. And the law actually states that in order for a child to be credible, the allegation or outcry or disclosure has to be made spontaneously, contemporaneously, of the child's own free volition, which is why we do discourage taping or asking a child questions. You know, and it, I mean, it's not wrong to ask a couple of questions. If you see a child that's acting sexually, is having issues like bedwetting and nightmares and flashbacks, curling up in a fetal position, thumb sucking and baby talk, you know, a bunch of regressive behaviors. Certainly you can ask a few questions, but you need to leave it to the professionals. You need to leave it to the certified interviewers. You know, and so this NICHD model, which was first published in 2000 by my colleague, Dr. Esplin, and a few other PhDs, is not used very much in America, in only about seven jurisdictions. And the reason is it's harder to obtain an outcry. You know, I'm not going to lie to you guys. It is more difficult to obtain an outcry or disclosure from a child when you ask a child the following questions. Can you tell me what happened? And then the child makes a statement. Tell me about that. Tell me more about that. Okay, so you're not putting any words or thoughts or ideas into the child's mind. You're letting the child tell his or her story spontaneously. And that's what the mm-hmm. law requires. And in order for the outcry to be reliable and trustworthy, those are the other two factors that succeed spontaneity. Like I said, the child's outcry has to be made spontaneously in order to get to reliability and trustworthiness. In Florida, we have what's called the Townsend factors, T-O-W-N-S-E-N-D, Townsend factors. That's the law governing a child's statements here in my state of Florida. And we actually have that case law is from 1994, State of Florida versus Townsend. And the Supreme Court of Florida outlined and articulated the factors that are determinable for the reliability of a child's statement, what they call extrajudicial statement or res gestae evidence, hearsay statements out of court made by children in cases down here. So it's a very specialized area of law. It's a very specialized area of science. And good luck in, you know, whether you still have the Yellow Pages or you're just using Google, in getting the right attorney to champion a case like this. Now, down in Sarasota, I went up against a very competent female attorney. Her name is Colleen Norman, and I would recommend her to any mom who has an issue with her own abuse or her child's abuse down in the Sarasota, Manatee, Bradenton area. Her name again, Colleen Norman.
Thank you.
You know, she is a specialist in these types of cases. It's difficult to find a specialist attorney in these types of cases.
Well, I'm making note of her name. Yeah, I appreciate you answering my question. It's very, it's a very difficult subject, obviously, especially for an adult survivor of child abuse to be, you know, thinking about children going through this process. And even though
it is.
Yeah. And obviously
Go ahead.
No, go on.
Well, the problem is you can put emotions before logic, because obviously no subject will drive more emotions in a mom or a dad or a grandma or grandpa or aunt or uncle than the child saying, "Daddy touched my pee-pee," or Joe next door, who we know, our next-door neighbor, touched my pee-pee. You know, you're going to go into, you know, hysterical nature on steroids.
Right.
So most child molestation occurs and is perpetrated by someone who the kid knows. So there's a good video online with Henry Winkler, Fonzie, and Marianne Hartley and John Ritter titled Strong Kids, Safe Kids on YouTube. The problem is it reports on stranger danger child molestation. That's really more a myth than reality. Because most molestation, most sexual assault is perpetrated by someone who the child does know.
That's correct.
So, but it is a good primer for kids to tell. And look, I encourage all kids to tell. I'm not saying that no kid should keep this a secret. You know, if you have been abused, absolutely you want to tell. You want to tell your teacher. You want to tell your babysitter. Mandated reporters, you want to tell your mom and get this properly investigated and handled. But there's a term in psychology called confirmation bias or confirmatory bias, where professionals, even investigating and interviewing these cases, can have a preconceived notion that they believe the abuse already happened. And like I said earlier, you can't give that opinion. I can't give that opinion. Unless a judge greenlights me to do so. And that's only happened once in my career. Once in my career in a criminal case from Alabama, did a judge allow me to give an opinion whether I thought the girls were sexually assaulted or not in that case.
Wow. Well, I commend you for the work that you do. It's not easy. By any means, and so thank you for everything that you do to find
thank
someone
you.
With integrity. Yeah, to fight for our children is very hard to find someone with integrity, and so we also really appreciate you being, you know, a part of NASCA and coming on for these shows, and they're very helpful and very informative. Because as you said, sometimes it's very hard to know where to start and where to go. Thank you.
Yeah, I was on, as I was telling Kim, I was on about a decade ago for Ruby Dillon in a case out of Orange County, California. And ironically, I was hired by her ex, the father in that case, and he was accused of molesting their daughter. And that case just spiraled out of control very quickly. And when I was hired, I was scratching my head because the attorneys I was working with for the father had cherry-picked just a couple of hundred pages of records of discovery to send to me. And usually when I get cases, there's, you know, they are a tome. They are just, you know, thousands of pages. It's a lot of stuff to go through. At any rate, the father, you know, was never arrested, never prosecuted for molesting the daughter. And Ruby got a hold of me on Facebook about 6 months after my retention and asked me if I was the guy that her ex hired. And I said, yes. Well, how much of the case did you see, Dean? I said, well, only a couple hundred pages. And she said, oh, no, I've got like 4,000 pages. I said, I'll tell you what, send me what you have, and I won't charge you a dime. And she did. And I read the rape report, which was not pretty. And I'm scratching my head why this guy wasn't arrested and charged. In California, usually it's a grand jury indictment. If you think Michael Jackson back to 2005, 2003 when he was indicted, 2005 when he went to trial. So I wound up switching sides from dad to mom. Midstream. I had never done that and have not done that again since that case from a decade ago. And I gave declarations. Declarations are a big thing in family court, in Superior Court in California. I gave two declarations for mom, for Ruby, in that case, supporting her position in the case. Because when her daughter was taken from her, she basically couldn't see her again. She was basically extricated from her life. And so the case garnered a lot of media attention. There's really not a lot a litigant can do, a parent can do. When you lose your case in a court of law, you have very little left by way of remedy. So I do encourage folks to, you know, use your voice, use your hands and your fingers on the keyboard, and utilize your First Amendment right to free speech and freedom of the press. Because the media can help you, but you do have to watch the media because it can be the fox guarding the hen house. So you got to be careful on that one as well. Trust is very difficult to grasp once you've been through these cases. You don't know who to trust because it seems like everybody is against you. So, you know, the child gets a lot of support in the way of professionals, not just out of court, but in court. The court usually appoints a guardian ad litem, an attorney representing the child. In California, that's called minor's counsel. In New York, that's called law guardian. Means the same thing. And so the child has counsel. The child usually has a child advocate. And there's a child forensic interviewer, and then, of course, there's your child protective services intake worker for CPS, at least one. If the case drags on for a year and a half, because the judge ordered the child into foster care, and the parents who go through what's called a case plan, hoops that they have to jump through to substantially comply with to get those kids back home, the case could see multiple caseworkers from CPS involved handling the case, usually does. So you can just imagine when you get to a trial, and I'm a trial guy, so most of my cases, it's a Mike Tyson war. There's going to be a winner and a loser. There's no, you know, smoke in the peace pipe at the 50-yard line. That just doesn't happen in my cases. So
are you competitive a little?
I'm sorry?
No, I mean, it's a good comp. Are you competitive just a little bit? You're like, I'm going to win
this. I guess that's the Boston. That's the Boston in me. That's where I was born and raised.
Boston.
So.
Well,
I took
you
that,
know what?
Took that to Florida and never lost it.
I can hear a little accent, a little bit of the accent in there.
Yeah, I've been down. I've been down here over 40
here.
Years. I'm sorry?
Have you really? We have a couple other people on the panel as well. So I was going to see if we could get to them. Thank you, Penelope.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Victoria. Yeah, thank you. She's always got the best questions. So, Victoria, I'm not sure if she wants to say anything or not, but I thought I'd check, Victoria.
Yeah, I would. So, Dean, I was looking at your webpage on Facebook, and I'm not going to read the whole post, but it says you testified last week at expert witness in a criminal case, and the judge said to me, I don't believe in parental alienation. It's science. And I was wondering if you could comment on that post and what the situation was.
Yeah, so I said back to the judge, I agree with him in part, because it's not published in the DSM-5-TR or the ICD-11, which are our psychiatric and medical Bibles. So obviously that immediately puts it in controversy. Immediately a judge could have a belief that it's not real science, it's just a theory. But an article came out, as I said in that post, also last year in Developmental Psychology that contained a literature review of 213 published peer-reviewed scientific articles on the issue of parental alienation by the experts such as Jennifer Harmon, Richard Warshak, William Bernay, Amy Baker. You go to Canada, Edward Kruk out of British Columbia. So, you know, it is recognized by the American Academy of Pediatrics. It is recognized by the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. And we talked about Daubert and Mohan a little earlier in this conversation. That is the science, the law, rather, that the judge has to draw a line to the science and connect those dots to see if it's actual science or not. So I told the judge, you know, Your Honor, I agree with you in part because it's not published in those medical psychiatric Bibles, but that it is recognized by, you know, the elite professional organizations. And this article, like I said, just this literature review just came out in Developmental Psychology last year, 2022.
Oh,
the judge said, you know what, Mr. Tong, I'm satisfied. You do meet the criteria as an expert, and you can move on, sir, and answer the questions that are fashioned to you by counsel.
Yeah, because I know the term, you know, parent alienation has been, you know, just all over the place, and that was very interesting to me, and especially now that you said it only a year ago that it really even an article came out in something that, you know, pretty much makes it valid, but that a lot of people use it, and I don't know if the attorneys would be able to come to, you know, a conclusion
There are clearly two schools of thought on this area of emotional, mental, psychological child abuse known as parental alienation, no doubt about it. And so when I get involved and I'm going to be giving expert testimony on parental alienation, I can pretty much tell I'm going to see a motion in limine. Motion in limine, L-I-M-I-N-E, which is a motion to limit or exclude my evidence, my testimony, based on whatever argument the opposing lawyer is making in the pleading. Junk science, hasn't been published in the DSM, ICD, whatever. That's going to trigger a Daubert hearing, which is a science and controversy hearing where the judge becomes the gatekeeper of the science. So the judge determines, like I said earlier, what is bona fide, genuine science or what is junk science. If the judge, you know, just has a steadfast belief it's junk science, then I'm pretty much whitewashed for that testimony. And if that's the only opinion that I'm going to have and make in the case, then I'm pretty much useless for the party who retained my services.
Yeah. I've heard so many people use it, and I didn't even realize that it hadn't been like around a long time, or that it's just common, you know, common term. Yeah, I appreciate answering the question, and I'm sure there's more people with questions because it's a really good subject. And I just want to thank you for being on too. And it's very helpful.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's like I said, it's a minefield. You don't make any friends in these cases. Usually when I come into a case, I have a target on my head, you kind of expect that. I guess it's like
not a popularity kind.
No, it's kind of like you're running back on a football team. You know you're going to get hit.
Yeah.
You know you're going to get hit, and you know you might suffer a concussion. You know you might suffer a traumatic brain injury.
Yeah. No.
Gosh.
Well, I'm
Thank
glad
you,
you're doing
Victoria.
What you're saying. It's very, very important. Uh-huh.
Yeah, we do.
So,
we have, thank you. We have, like, three other people on the line here still. So let's see if we can get, because we only are down to 33 minutes. The time goes so fast. And let's see if we can get to a couple other people. Thanks, Victoria. Now we have LaQuisha. LaQuisha, I'm bringing you on the air with Dean. Did you have something you wanted to say? Did I say your name right? Maybe she doesn't have anything to say. Okay, so I'm going to put you back on hold here, and we'll go to the next person down here. Hi, you're on the air. Phone number 1116, the last four digits. Did you have anything that you wanted to say? Oh, Albert. Okay. Just listening. Well, I guess we didn't have a whole lot of other questions. Thanks, Valerie. So I'm kind of curious, because now, are you able to go anywhere to do these forensic interviews and testify? Or, I mean, because I guess I thought that most attorneys and things, although I know you're a specialty, but are kind of, you know, limited to whatever, I guess, that they are licensed in, right?
Okay, well, I'm not an attorney, so I'm not a lawyer. And
so you're
not
a lawyer. Okay.
Right. And I don't conduct the child forensic interviews. So when you conduct child forensic interviews, you have to work for the government. Okay, you have to work for the government, because you will be doing your job at what's called the Child Advocacy Center, or unless you're a research academic, like a PhD, conducting a research study, what's called an informed consent research study that involves interviewing children as part of that study, and the parents of those children, of course, have to sign the consent form. That would be the only way you could interview children in a non-governmental child forensic interview. But all child forensic interviews are conducted by governmental employees. I work for the defense. I'm not a government, a state expert. So what I do is I critique those interviews. I've looked at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of child forensic interviews across this, across North America, because I've had cases from Canada as well, for decades. And so, you know, I get a lot of cases. And some cases have 4, 5, 6, 8 children. And those children may have been forensically interviewed 2 or 3 times. So you can imagine some cases may have 20 or 25 DVDs I have to look at.
Yeah, I have another question. I'll make sure that you get in before the time runs out. Could you let us know about how to get a hold of you, and then your website, of course, what it's called and what's on it and things like that.
Sure. Yeah, so I have two websites, abuse-excuse.com. Abuse-excuse.com has been on the internet since 1997. That is my primary website. And, of course, I get criticized a lot by the title of that website, that I'm trying to find an excuse for parents to beat the rap, if you will. And that's just not the case, because if you think back to the Menendez brothers in California who shot their parents in cold blood and killed them back in the 90s, they believed they were molested by their parents. So there's an abuse excuse where the perpetrators of homicide were trying to use their own abuse from their childhood to get a lower sentencing on their homicides. So that's where that comes from. But I also have a second website, which is an academic website at academia.edu. I don't know if you all can access that, not being members of that website. But it's if you put my name in the search box at academia.edu, and you're able to scroll around there, you'll find my page over there. But my primary site is abuse-excuse.com. I've written 3 books. I'm also a published author. My books were published in 1992, 1997, and 2002. The 2002 book, Elusive Innocence, Survival Guide for the Falsely Accused, still sells a lot of books today, over 20 mm-hmm. years later. At Amazon, you'll see the book. I think it has like 69 reviews over there or something. But that book is pretty much a how-to guide for attorneys and parents who are involved in these cases, who don't have much money but do have 10 or 15 bucks to read how to navigate a high conflict case like this, to be able to declare their names, assuming they're innocent.
Mm-hmm. I went to the excuse.com website and I did scroll down the page a little bit, and it says, "We do not excuse." And then so you gave, you know, the unspeakable acts of prey upon our children, which, you know, really, I was really happy about. I was wondering who the guy was who put a round circle with an X in.
Yeah, I don't know who that guy was. I know. Had to get permission. I had to get permission to use his photo over 20 years
ago.
Yeah,
I was going to say I wouldn't want to be that guy. Even though when you see like these people are models or whatever, you know, you go, are they?
You know, and I started helping moms on the other side of this divisive coin back in 2004.
Yeah.
I appeared on Dr. Phil with Bridget Marks, M-A-R-K-S, and she was a lady out of New York who had twin daughters, and she was like my client in Daytona Beach I alluded to earlier. She was accused of coaching her daughters to falsely accuse their father of sexual assault, and the judge took custody away from mom just based on the allegations that surfaced through Child Protective Services through
yeah.
the kids. So I worked that case, and we had to go to the appellate court to try to get relief, and we won. We won on appeal. So Bridget got her kids back in 2005, and she never looked back in the rearview mirror again. Those kids are adults now.
Mm-hmm. And then I noticed, too, on the website, I just want to let people know that you have a whole bunch of, it says, false abuse allegations as well as false allegations of child sexual assault. And you've got click here, click here, click here, click here. I don't know how many there are, but different court cases and different.
There are legal reviews. Yeah, there are legal reviews, scientific reviews,
mm-hmm.
statutes. There's a lot of stuff over there. I mean, it's really overwhelming. There's so much information
yeah.
on over there.
There's a lot of reading that, you know, even just without clicking, there's a lot of information right there. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's good to see websites that have more than just, you know, name, contact, and a few pictures.
So, one tidbit of advice I will give people out there, you know, whether your child has been sexually abused or you're a parent who's been falsely accused of the same, be very mindful of vetting any prospective attorney you would retain before you do so. So, for example, there's a man by the name of Richard Ducote, D-U-C-O-T-E, D-U-C-O-T-E. And he's got to be in his late 70s or 80 now. I believe he's back in Louisiana. I know he had to uproot from Louisiana when Hurricane Katrina hit. He relocated and passed the bar in Pennsylvania because I had a case against him in 2011 in Pennsylvania. And I just got a call from another gentleman just a couple of weeks ago who's litigating against Mr. Ducote in Louisiana. So I think he's back in Louisiana. But the point is, he's a really fine attorney for moms whose kids have been sexually abused. I mean, this is all he does, and he's been doing this for probably about 50 years.
Oh.
And the same goes,
thing I wanted to ask you to share on the other show I think you talked about is where a mother actually did something to the kid to say that the father did it. If I'm not mistaken, that was you that was talking about that, to try to make the father look guilty. I could be talking to a different person.
I don't know if that...
God done their child or something. And...
Well,
anyway,
the case I had from Florida, the mother was accused of coaching her 4-year-old son to say the dad anally sodomized him. So the government believed she was falsely accusing him, which is unusual because usually CPS comes in actual cases where they believe the kid was molested, not the other way where they think the father was falsely accused. So I wrote an article on coaching. So if you guys go to divorcemag.com or divorcemagazine.com, just put my name in the search box, you'll see an article that I wrote on a backlash against moms who've been falsely accused of coaching. Coaching is synonymous with emotional, psychological child abuse.
Yeah.
And so CPS can come after you.
This person was on the other day, and they were talking about the mother to get, to get custody, whatever, had taken the girl to the bathroom and, rubbed her genitals and stuff, and then brought her to the doctor and had coached the kids to say that, my dad did this to me. And, they arrested the dad, whatever. And it finally, came out in the long run that the mother had done that to, make dad look bad. And we were discussing at one point, okay, so the father got basically, you didn't do it. But the mother, nothing happened to her. And as far as I'm concerned, that right there is sexual abuse. If you're hurting a kid, nothing was done to the mother.
The mother should have been arrested for rubbing the child's genital.
Yeah, really leave red marks and then accusing dad. I just don't understand how that couldn't be sexual abuse.
That right there. If that came out in CPS records and court records and court testimony, the mother should have been arrested for inappropriate touching, lewd, lascivious molestation of this child. Absolutely.
Right.
But down here in my state of Florida, that is a life felony. Florida statute 800.04, you can go to prison for life without parole.
On the judge and depends on the state as well with something that wasn't prosecuted like that. And it can still be prosecuted after the...
Absolutely. Most states, false accusations are considered no big deal. We don't like to publish that because it gives women and children a chilling effect from reporting abuse in the future. So we're not going to prosecute you if you incite a witch hunt. Don't do that again, but at worst, we're going to give you a slap on the wrist. Well, not so in Florida. Down here, it's a felony. You can go to prison for up to 5 years.
Good. That's good to hear. I appreciate that. You're cracking down on people if they are.
Well, but the police, if you ask the police, how many cases do you arrest and prosecute of false accusations of child abuse? They will tell you very, very, very few. And the reason is they don't want to stifle kids. They want kids to be able to talk about this, and they should be able to talk about this. They get good touch, bad touch programs in school. They get educational programs, and obviously – daddy and mommy have to go over the birds and the bees when the kids get to be almost puberty age. You know, all that stuff has to be broached with the child. We're not saying don't do that. Go ahead and do all that. Just be very careful what you're saying to your kid, because kids don't have the same memory brain formation as we have as adults, and they're very suggestible. They're very impressionable.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? We are down to 19 minutes. So what else in these last few minutes on air would you like to share with us?
Well, I guess we could talk about coercive control. It's kind of the new kid on the block, if you will.
Yeah, tell us about that.
So coercive control is really extreme psychological abuse. And obviously we see this in actual cases of domestic violence where women are controlled by men domestically and physically. It could be false imprisonment, held against their own, not allowed to leave, not allowed to use their cell phone to call 911, not allowed to go get their car to get away, not allowed to go to the battered women's shelter. So that's coercive control. Now, we also see this on the flip side, where in cases of severe parental alienation, where, say, for example, I'll just give a hypothetical, that a mom is not wanting dad to see the kid for whatever reason. Dad has a new girlfriend. Dad's not paying his child support. She basically enmeshes to the kid, so the child loses emotional attachment to the dad, and all the attachment goes to the mom. And now we're seeing that the child, after a while, will not want to communicate or see the father, who becomes the targeted parent. And so this is another form of coercive control, just the reverse flip side. And we're starting to see states adopt statutes consistent with this, what they call coercive control. I had a case about a year ago from the state of Hawaii where the judge basically had a hearing on this coercive control issue. And it can be a deciding psychological issue in determining parenting time and custody. So again, but usually in coercive control, if an attorney is unsuccessful in litigating his position or her position in court, you're going to need expert testimony. The attorney will need expert testimony for the case.
Well, you come in, yeah.
In some cases, it's common sense. The parent may want to hire a PhD, a psychologist, or an MD, a psychiatrist, who is more credentialed than me. And the law does not require that you hold a PhD or MD to be an expert. There are some experts out there in America who only have bachelor's degrees. So long as you can relate to the court by education and experience and knowledge that you possess the credentials and qualifications to be an expert, regardless of how degreed you are, you will be cloaked as an expert by the court or not.
Oh, okay.
So the one thing courts do not like is ideology. They detest ideology or theories that are unpublished and not born in science, theories that have not been replicated, that have not been tested, they've not been peer-reviewed, they've not attained clinical or statistical significance, they do not have, they have not attained what we call inter-rater reliability. So very important that if you are testifying as an expert to any psychological theory, whether it's coercive control, parental alienation, child sex abuse accommodation syndrome, the CSAAS, You'll find a Wikipedia page on that, the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. Whatever theory the expert is testifying to, the expert better know that theory inside and out and be able to articulate the knowledge to the court. Otherwise, the judge will probably shoot you down and disqualify you. And if you're disqualified, you cannot give an opinion. And therefore, you cannot help the client who paid you, who retained you.
It's all really fascinating to me. So thank you so much for tonight because my mom worked as a paralegal when I was young. And I think she just knew all the ins and outs, but she was also the person that enabled my abuser, my stepdad, who not only physically abused me, but also sexually abused me. And basically I was told it happens. And she passed away about 20 years ago now. But I've kind of wondered, you know, because you do, I guess, if I would have ever been taken out of the home, you know, what that would have looked like, who would have advocated. Because you hear so many stories, you really do. And there's a lot of bad things that happen, especially when kids get taken away a lot of times. And so, you know, I don't know if it was worse or what, you know, or better that my mom was able to manipulate and make everybody think that we were a perfect family. And behind the scenes, my dad was actually a heroin addict and he was molesting me, and it was just crazy. When I look back, I'm like, I survived that.
I'm sorry to hear.
It's crazy when you think about it. And I'm like, what would have happened if I would have gone, you know, if I would have been rescued? Because I think at the time I wanted to be. And that's why I told my mom what had happened, you know, is because I wanted somebody to help me. And one of the reasons why I'm so passionate, I know that darkness to light can come a long way, but it's got all of those elements that you were talking about as far as, you know, the evidence base and, you know, all of the interviews and everything that they do, and just make sure that it's really trauma-informed.
Yeah, it's
and
a lot
so
of work
really
because
that.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's a lot of work. I mean, when I'm helping an attorney, the attorney obviously knows the law, knows the rules of court, the rules of procedure, the rules of evidence, knows the facts of the case or alleged facts of the case. Then my job is to review and critique all the reports from the professionals, from Child Protective Services to the detectives, to the child forensic interviewers, to the therapists, guardians ad litem, attorneys for the child. There may be a guardian ad litem attorney and a guardian ad litem who's just a layperson, advocate helping the child. So it's a lot of work, and then you have to go over the policies and procedure manuals of Child Protective Services and the police and the Child Advocacy Center where they're doing the forensic interviews with a fine-tooth comb to make sure the government did their job. Because I can tell you when you walk into court, if this is a tennis match, advantage government. Every time, advantage government. So the accused, if you have been wrongly accused, or even perhaps if you've been abused, actually abused, the government always has a leg up because, you know, that's an agency that is court appointed. It's an agency that gets involved on their own and obviously has total immunity. Here in America, the Child Protective Services Agency enjoys what we call 11th Amendment sovereign immunity. So, it's just a lot of vetting, a lot of fact-checking, a lot of going back and forth to see that they did everything that they were supposed to do. And so you can imagine when you come into court and you're on the opposite side of the government, you're immediately reviled and put under a microscope.
Well, we definitely appreciate you coming on this evening. So
I would like to also chime in for a kind of a push for parents. I, you know, work a lot with Battered Women through the Battered Women Shelter, and what you're talking about, downgrading the, as you know, because the women, it was women, downgrading the fathers all the time to the kids, just irked me so bad. I had two children that I was not with their fathers, and their fathers weren't in their life. But in the back of my mind, I never, ever wanted to do that. You know, my grandma always put down my mom. I was raised by my grandparents. Always put down my mom, and I always felt like, you know, I'm half of my mom. And I must be all those things that, you know, or I compare myself. Oh, well, I kind of do some of that, you know, or whatever. And it can really damage a child. I just, you know, both of their dads were not good people. And then, you know, if they would have asked, they would have just said, it's just not safe to be around them. But some of these mothers were just like saying every little thing and calling them names and all this and that, whether they were visitation or not. And it just really, really bothered me. So it's a message to parents. You're not helping the kids any by putting down the dad. They will figure out for themselves person the other parent is. No, I'm not saying like if there's abuse or anything to not talk about it, but not like, you know, oh, he's an effing jerk and this and that and all of that all the time. So I just wanted to throw that out there because it can really get into trouble.
You know, I get hotly contested child custody cases with or without abuse allegations. And I always tell parents, you know, you always put the needs of the child or children ahead of your own.
That's right.
You neither denigrate nor vilify the opposing parent, and you actually, by law, are required to foster and nurture the relationship of the child or children with the opposing parent. Mm-hmm. And look, in all courts, it's about the child's best interest. It's not about mom's best interest. It's not about dad's best interest.
Mm-hmm.
So when a judge is ruling and doing an analysis of the child best interest factors. So, for example, in my state of Florida, there were 20 factors that the court has to go over and consider before issuing an order on custody, or what we call down here time sharing. It's only about the child. The judge has an obligation and allegiance to the child and only the child. It's when the judge abuses his or her discretion in ruling on the child is when that judge can be appealed to a higher court.
Okay. Yeah.
So,
but unfortunately, there's no judges or people that are educating these parents about how harmful it is to the kids when you're doing that. Unfortunately, you know, I said to many parents, you know, both sides, is that in the best interest of the child, you know? And you know, I always say it takes a village to raise a child, because my kids were raised in foster care in different situations, respite care and things like that. And, you know, I never put down them. I always was so grateful that they helped. Now, I know not every kid goes into a good situation.
Yeah,
in foster
you had
care.
A good I've
placed my children in permanent foster care, and that was my decision because I was in a psych ward and they were bouncing around the system. That was my decision, but there are good places for kids to go, and, you know, and they did. They want to reunify us, and I just said, no, I just, you know, this is just not working. I start doing really well. I get my kids back, and I end up back in the psych ward. I got a lot of work to do, you know, kind of. But I do want to comment on the thing. I used to call myself crazy all the time. Until somebody said, you're not crazy. What was done to you was crazy. You reacted normally
to
crazy situations.
We need to,
so I want to end that.
We need
that.
To understand
thanks,
that.
Thanks, Jean, for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Victoria. I just wanted Penelope maybe to have a turn because we're down to just a few more minutes. So I didn't know if Penelope had anything else that she wanted to say real quick.
Excuse me. Is this the night to have stuff in people's throats? I don't know, but I caught up.
Yeah,
caught with me. No, I just want to really, I mean, say thank you. I'm so, you know, appreciative always, you know, to be able to, you know, fit in these shows, and I learned so much, and I really just wish to thank you, you know, Kim and Victoria, And also, Dean, just, you know, so the knowledge that you shared and just the ability to know that, that you're out there as a resource for NASCA is really just so appreciative. So thank you very much. I learned a lot of notes, and hopefully we'll hear you again in the future. So thank you very much. I don't have any more questions. I just really want to express my gratitude.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
I reiterate that, too. Everything Penelope said, we appreciate you being on. And, you know, and of course, you're a part of the NASCA family. We would love to have you call in anytime if there's ever a topic that interests you and you think you can have a good input on it.
Yeah, I just want to acknowledge April coming up here. Of course, is National Child Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month, the month of the child. So everybody think about that, the 30 days in April, that that's the month that we honor children.
If I could bring up this really quickly, me and another woman is, I'm going to try to get out a NASCA newsletter, which we haven't done in a while, and I just wanted to ask people, and Dean as well, we're looking for, you know, any kind of articles or information or anything that we could put in there because it hasn't been done for quite a while. Bill just can't get it done, the founder. And so Indiana Soto and myself are going to be taking that on. And I just want to let people know, you know, that are listening as well. You can contact us on the Facebook group or you can contact me as well. I'm on NASCA. My phone number's on there. I'm the Minnesota ambassador. And I just, you know,
thank
think
you,
we really need to get that. We really need to get that newsletter out in April because it is Child Abuse Awareness Prevention Month.
Yeah.
It's also Sexual Assault Awareness Month,
that.
Which a lot of people say, well, that just includes kids too. And it's like, yeah, it does. But then you miss out on all the stuff, other stuff that, you know, that involves children and abuse. Yeah.
Well, there's
so many. Throw that in.
So many issues. Well, that's exciting, Victoria. Thank you for doing that, for letting us know. So again, Dean, just tell us how to get a hold of you. Tell us like your website and your book again is Elusive Innocence.
That's correct.
Is that what you were saying? Yeah. And and that's available on Amazon or and
Amazon, my website. Folks may want to choose Amazon. Pretty trustworthy place, obviously, since COVID. And my website, the website abused. Yes, I am on Facebook. I do have some room to accept friends, so folks can friend me. I do offer a pro bono service over there and have for years to be able to guide people in their cases without obviously giving opinions because I'm not seeing documents. I'm going by hearsay. But a lot of people do get a hold of me, and I do answer their questions. So you may find me accessible if you query me, whereas you may have a hard time getting a hold of an attorney or a psychologist or psychiatrist.
Well, thank you so much, Dean, for that information. And I believe that I followed you. I didn't see a friend request, but I'll connect with you. I appreciate you and thank you again for being on all that you've contributed.
Thank you for having me.
Very informative. And, you know, as we like to say, that there's enough eyes and ears out there in the world to be protecting every child that's out there. And so we need to be the voice for the children, and we need to be the adults and start acting like adults and stop putting these responsibilities onto the kids so we can make a difference. So if you see something, please say something. Have a good evening, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that's gone.